May be seated. All right, as the court is back in session, the second case set for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Tristan Larson. Brad Schreiber appears and will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Larson. And Paul Swedland is appearing and will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each attorney will have 20 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Schreiber, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. There is a small warning light up here, and when it turns yellow, you've got 2 minutes. I'll try to give you a warning if as we're getting close. So with that, Mr. Schreiber, you may proceed with your opening argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Swedland. I appreciate the opportunity to argue this case before the court today. Thank you. And I want to go through the facts of this case a little bit before I get into the argument. As the court knows, back on April 28th of 2020, Tristan Larson was indicted for the crimes of second-degree murder, 2 alternative counts of manslaughter, aggravated battery of an infant, and there was also a part 2 information alleging him to be a habitual offender that was filed in February of 2021. Mr. Larson pled not guilty to the charges in the indictment, and after the trial, he admitted to being a habitual offender. Now, facts in this case are on April 11th of 2020. Tristan Larson and his girlfriend at the time, who is Elizabeth Felix, have been in a relationship for approximately 11 months. Elizabeth brought into this relationship a son. He was about two years old at the time. When this matter happened, Tristan and Elizabeth and their son were living with Tristan's mother in Pierce, South Dakota. She had a residence in Pierce, and they all resided together. During the time frame, Elizabeth was employed at a local sporting goods store in Pierce. And what the normal course was, when she was working, Tristan would take care of Easton, who was the 2-year-old son during this period of time. He would take care of Easton at the family residence. He would care for him. He would bathe him. He would feed him. He would clothe him until mom would get home at the end of the day. And so what they would do is Tristan, Easton, and Elizabeth would get together in a car. He'd drive her up to her place of employment. And he would go back home, taking care of Easton for the rest of the day. And towards the end of the day, when she was about off work, he would go up and get her and bring her home. On April 11th, what happened is they had gone through that routine that morning. They had taken Elizabeth up to the sporting goods store. And it's about just a few blocks away from where they were residing. After Tristan had dropped Elizabeth off, he came home, and Elizabeth got a phone call from Tristan about 20 to 30 minutes later, advising that he had pushed Easton down and he wasn't waking up. It took Elizabeth about 20 to 30 minutes to walk down. Tristan wanted to come get her. She didn't want Easton left alone in the house or to be moved or anything else. So she got hold of her employer, was able to walk back down to the house, which was about a 20 or 30 minute walk. So what happened in the house while Elizabeth was at work is Tristan was caring for Easton. It came time that he was supposed to take a bath. And what Easton would commonly do is he didn't want to take a bath. He would walk over to the closet where his clothing was. And the way it was described, what Easton would want to do is not take a bath. He just wanted to put on his clothes. Tristan told him that if he would not get bathed, that he was going to spank him. And so Easton would walk back towards him, stand in front of him. Tristan would tell him, you got to take off your clothes. You have to have a bath. When Easton would not obey him at this point in time, he said, okay, turn around. I'm going to have to spank you. And Easton was, the evidence would indicate that he was crying. And at some point, what ended up happening is Tristan pushed him, and what happened, he fell down on the floor. He didn't hit his head on anything but the floor. Easton tried to get up. He fell back down to the floor. Tristan attempted to wake him. get some sort of response, and he was unsuccessful. That's when he called Elizabeth, said, Easton isn't waking up. And that's when she told him, I will walk down, don't come and get me. So it took her about 20, 30 minutes to walk back to the house. What happened at that time when Elizabeth arrived, she noticed that Easton was on the couch. Tristan had picked him up and put him on the couch. He was not dead. He was still alive. I believe Elizabeth had testified during trial that she could hear him breathing and making some sort of a grunting sound at that point in time. What they end up doing is calling Tristan's mother to come home, basically told her what happened, generally told her what happened. She came home, tried to get some sort of response, and they decided that he had to be taken to the hospital. So he was taken to the hospital in Pierre. They were advised that he had a brain bleed, and he was subsequently transferred to Sioux Falls. Tristan, his mom, Elizabeth, all ended up going to Sioux Falls. They all stayed there for the next couple of days. And Easton passed away on 2 days later on the 18th. Now, what we have done in this case is we have filed a motion to suppress before trial. And the motion to suppress was to suppress a statement that was made by Tristan to Pierre Police Department. And he was interrogated by Detective Dusty Pelley, who's a 17-year veteran with the Pierre Police Department. During that investigation, he was read his Miranda rights. Tristan was read his Miranda rights, and he gave affirmative answers to waiving those particular rights. Our issue with what happened at that period of time is that his waiver at that time was not voluntary, intelligent, or knowingly made. In the court's findings, we submitted findings of fact, conclusions of law subsequent to the hearing. The court found that almost immediately, Tristan was remorseful and emotional. She found that at times he was highly emotional during this period of time. There were periods where he was intermittently emotional, and he appeared to be sleeping at the times. Well, we have filed on appeals asking the court to find that the trial court erred, finding that because of these findings of the court, that he exhibited signs of what I would call exhaustion. He exhibited signs of severe emotion at times, that he could not have made an intelligent, voluntary waiver of his rights.
Mr. Schreiber, is your argument on appeal that what you just said, of course, that I got.
Certainly.
Of course. Is that the argument, or is there an additional argument that the statement itself was not voluntary, or is it really directed to that, to the Miranda warning, which is, you know, was a prophylactic warning that police can give and obviate some of the problems that might otherwise exist with voluntariness arguments? So is it just to the waiver, or is it to the statement itself, or both? Or
it would be to both. And what I would, I guess, when I review the law on this, and I don't intend to waive any argument made here, and I would rely upon my brief for anything that I don't argue here today. But one of the cases that the court relies upon, which is, I say it's Coder, I don't know if it's Cotier or Cotier, indicates that there are other factors besides mental impairments and besides sleeplessness and besides emotional states that should be considered when, you know, reviewing whether or not a waiver is voluntary and intelligently made. But what that case said is that the state emotional swings and apparent exhaustion raise a question of whether or not he was fully aware of waiving his rights and the consequences of waiving them. And that comes from Cotier. That is the primary issues that we are arguing on this particular motion. At that point in time, when he's exhibiting these signs of exhaustion, sleeplessness, and the emotion that he was expressing, there was actually a video played to the jury, and you could see that you could see the emotion. That's what the court reviewed when the motion to suppress was offered. But these are still relevant. These types of impairments are still relevant to determining whether or not there has been a valid waiver. Did he understand them? And I would submit that there's no evidence in this record that would indicate that he understood the consequences of waiving them, of waiving his right. No evidence of it. I guess an argument could be made that when he says yeah or yes, maybe he understood it, but I think you've got to look at the context of the elements that I've just, the factors that I've just identified and the emotion that he was exhibiting. And the court, in their findings of fact, put a lot of emphasis or noted more than once the emotional state that Tristan was in when he was going through this. He had just come from Sioux Falls. He'd been in Sioux Falls, left that day from where Easton was at, came back, voluntarily goes to the police department is what he ends up doing. He goes there voluntarily. And this little boy, whom he treated as being his own son, had just passed away. It's what happened.
Was he in custody? I mean, if he went there voluntarily, maybe there's a custody issue. Would Miranda even be required if he had gone there voluntarily and didn't feel as though he was going to be arrested at the end of it?
He had gone to the police department voluntarily to see what the police department wanted. There's no question about that. He ends up being in an interrogation room, and you know, if in the video, it's very clear he's basically in a box of four walls is what he's in. So he is there. I think Dusty Pelley indicated that he could leave at any point in time, I think, during the conversation. So there may be an argument that he was not in custody. So if he's there voluntarily, obviously, you know, it's going to be tough to argue that he was in custody.
Is that issue addressed in front of the circuit court?
The custody issue? No, I don't believe so. I think our only issue is...
And the circuit court specifically found that he was in custody, correct?
I believe that's correct. I believe that's correct. And it would be hard for me to argue otherwise if he's there voluntarily. What ends up happening is Pelley advises him of his rights and asks, do you understand these rights? One thing I want to get into that I didn't spend a lot of time in my brief, and it's not just one right. He's advised of five different things in one statement. He's advised of his right to remain silent. He's advised that he can stop the questioning at any point in time. He's advised, his third thing, anything he says may be used against him. Five or four, he has a right to consult with and have an attorney present. And the fifth one is he has a right to a court-appointed lawyer. So he has five things in this emotional state that he's in that he's got to consider. And he's got to waive all of those for this to be a valid waiver. And he's got to understand them and understand the consequences of waiving them.
And that was an advisement from a card. It's the standard Miranda warning given in the vast majority of circumstances.
I would agree. It's something we've heard many, many times, and this court has probably put that into many opinions the same exact way. But when I look at this, we look at different circumstances for each case like this in making a determination whether or not it's an intelligent and voluntary waiver. These circumstances, the state has cited cases where there's alcohol, might have been alcohol involved, where there might have been intoxication. And I would say this case is different from those cases. We just have a simply different set of circumstances. But nothing in that colloquy, that short colloquy where Detective Pelley is advising Tristan of his rights, gives any indication that Larson understood the consequences of waiving his rights. And I think that's very important in this particular case. If you don't understand the consequences of the waiver, it's not going to be voluntary. It can't be knowing and it can't be an intelligent. You have to know you're giving up these constitutional rights.
What would you have expected the record to show then?
I guess what I would like to see, and you know, this would certainly create new case law, in my opinion, these rights need to be more explained. Is what they need to do. Now, I don't think the law requires that right now, but arguably it may require that because if they're going to understand the consequences of waiving these rights, they need to understand what each one of these rights is. What's the right to remain silent? What does that mean? What's the consequence of it? Well, it can be used against you if you talk to us. Well, what does that mean? What that means is if you talk to us and confess to a crime, you might be convicted of it. Now, that can be a lot more clear than just simply saying can be used against you.
Counsel, we have quite a body of case law that talks about all the other factors that we look at to make that determination, whether this was a knowing involuntary waiver. And here, didn't the court also look at some of those factors, in particularly with regard to Mr. Larson and his background in the criminal justice system and those sorts of things that went into the court's analysis?
I agree with you 100%, Justice Devaney. The other factors, I'm going to try and say them from my head, are his age, his experience in the justice system. I believe his level of intellect are all factors to be considered. And the court did make those findings and did take those things into consideration. But I don't think, with regard to understanding the consequences of waiving, I mean, that is more specific than simply examining those factors. You can say, okay, Tristan was about 22, 23 years old at the time. So, you know, in my opinion, he's still a kid. He's youth. He's not a teenager. He's not a juvenile. But to me, he's still a kid. He had some exposure in the criminal justice system. Not of this level, not of this nature, but he did have previous experience in the criminal justice system. You know, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know. He admitted to a habitual offender information is what he ended up doing, which is an indication that he had been involved in the system before.
So you're arguing, in essence, for an expansion of our jurisprudence. You'd like to see a more detailed advisement. Do you have authority from around the country that you would point to or rely upon? And I guess to follow up on Justice Myron's inquiry, what are you proposing the record should have reflected? An individual assessment of the five rights you named off, a specific waiver for each of those five rights. Can you expand on your argument?
And I can. And I don't have authority for what I just stated, Justice Kern, but I see a problem. I see a problem there, is what I see. What I would like to have seen the record reflect more is more of a discussion between Pelley and Larson that he understood the consequences, but that is left out of that discussion between Pelley and Larson. I don't know anything in this record that I can point to say that he understood the consequences of waiving those rights.
Now, Mr. Larson didn't ask Detective Pelley any questions about how these rights would operate.
Did Mr. Larson?
He did not, did he?
No, he did not.
So what would prompt, in your mind, Detective Pelley to suddenly go into it, some deeper explanation of the rights, absent a question from Mr. Larson that would indicate he didn't understand one of them?
I think his level of emotion, he was obviously, and this level of emotion extended all the way through this interrogation. There are times he would lay his head down on the table. There are times he had his head in his hands. The level of emotion and the level of exhaustion.
But at the time of the waiver, when he's read his Miranda rights and he makes the waiver, his head's down in the first part, then he lifts his head up and he looks at Detective Pelley and says, yes, I'm waiving them. There's been no expression of emotion prior to that in the interview. It all takes place after the waiver, is my recollection. Am I incorrect?
I'm not going to tell you you're incorrect. I don't have an independent recollection of that. But even if it happens afterwards, Justice Myron, I would think that would trigger in law enforcement or anybody who's conducting that type of interrogation. There might be something wrong here, and maybe we need to re-examine this. That's, now, if you ask me to cite a case that says that, I can't cite you to a case. But I see a problem with the way this is done, and in circumstances where somebody may be impaired by exhaustion or by this level of emotion, or might be 22 to 23 years old.
Mr. Shriver, you're coming up on, or you are in 2 minutes. You want to talk at all about your motion for judgment of acquittal?
I certainly do. Thank you. The motion for judgment of acquittal, Tristan was convicted of second-degree murder and aggravated battery of an infant. And just with regard to second-degree burglary, we don't believe that there is any evidence that my client had a depraved mind at the time that this accident occurred. And I'm not saying you need to reevaluate the evidence in this case. I'm saying there is no evidence of a depraved mind in this situation. And I just want to give you a factual. This happened in a bedroom. This happened in a bedroom where a young boy was pushed. Now, the state's pointed out that there were other terms used during the interrogation, like a shove and things like that. After reviewing the transcript of this interrogation, the push is the word that was used more than anything else during this interrogation, not only by my client, but by Detective Pelley. And I also reviewed the redirect examination by, I believe it was Mr. Kempema, at the end of the cross-examination of Detective Pelley. And part of that discussed this act. The prosecutor used the word push. Detective Pelley uses the word push. This was a push, is what it was. Basically, the same argument we would use with respect to aggravated battery of an infant, because we don't believe there's any evidence of recklessness. And I would only point out this analogy. When you have to look at the circumstances of the situation that you're in, the circumstances, my client was in a bedroom, pushed his child, fell on a carpeted floor. If Mr. Swedlin and I are walking along the edge of the Grand Canyon, and I give him a little push, only intending to scare him, not intending for him to fall off, and he falls off, because I'm on the edge of the Grand Canyon, might look at that as being either reckless or with a depraved mind. Or if I push him while he's got a loaded firearm, you could reach the same conclusion. But I don't think you can reach the same conclusion when this wasn't a situation where there's furniture where Easton was going to fall into or anything like that. This was a carpeted bedroom, and this young boy fell on a carpeted floor.
Your time is up, Mr. Shriver.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Ms. Swedlin, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. As Mr. Shriver just described, this isn't a whodunit. Tristan Larson admitted that he struck Easton Felix in the head hard, too hard. And think about that a minute, because we're talking about a child that's between 18 and 24 inches high. In order to hit this child, he has to scoop down to hit him in the forehead like a golf swing. That's not a natural type of movement. That is a movement that is premeditated. He hit him hard enough that he knocked the child off his feet and he fell backward and hit his head on the floor. Now, it's not hitting his head on the floor that killed him. We know that because the brain bleed is up in the front of his temporal lobes, right behind the area where he was struck. That's what killed him. It doesn't matter whether he fell on a carpeted floor or into a goose down pillow, because what killed him is the blow to his forehead. After that, things happen rapidly. The brain starts bleeding. The brain starts swelling. The swelling causes pressure on the brain stem. That's the part of the central nervous system that controls breathing. After a while, his breathing becomes labored. And the only thing that was going to save that child at that point in time was if he had perhaps been scooped up and taken to the hospital immediately. That's not what happened either. Mr. Larson waited 40 minutes before he got that kid to the hospital. Those 40 minutes made the difference in whether this kid lived or died or not, potentially.
Was there evidence of that in trial, that 40 minutes?
Yes. Well, and we heard from Mr. Schreiber a moment ago when he first waits and then he calls the mom. And then
No. Was there evidence that made a difference in terms that the child could have been saved had he been taken to the hospital?
It's just common medical knowledge.
And was that a theory that you presented to the jury, that the depravity of mind was the failure to take him to the hospital?
Well, it was a component of it. The main component of the depravity of the action is the fact that he hits this child on the forehead and hits him hard. And the case law is pretty well developed, including a statute in South Dakota, 2218.1.4, that says if you cause bleeding in the brain of a child, if you do that recklessly, that's aggravated battery of an infant. So inherent in that statute is common knowledge that hitting a child hard on the head is potentially lethal. That's part of the law that Mr. Larson was responsible for being aware of.
But a moment ago, it seemed like you were also arguing that part of the depravity of mind was failing to take Easton to the hospital in that 40 minutes. Is that an argument that was presented to the jury? The jury was, someone argued to the jury on behalf of the state that you should find him guilty, and the depravity of mind was his failure to render aid.
Yes, certainly that was a component of the depravity. It's the fact that he waited so long. The first thing that crosses his mind is F. He's effing dead. He knows that hitting a kid too hard in the head can result in that child dying, but he did it anyway. And he had to do it purposefully, and he had to aim down low, and he hit the kid hard, too hard. Those are Mr. Larson's own words. So Mr. Larson then tries to argue, well, I didn't intend to kill him. Well, if he'd intended to kill him, that'd be first degree murder. He wasn't charged with first degree murder. He was charged with an act that was depraved and charged with an act that is reckless. So the charging decision already took account for the fact that Mr. Larson didn't intend to kill him. What's important here is that he intended to hit him. And Mr. Larson admits that he intended to hit him, and he even admits that he hit him too hard. So under the facts of this case, the state submits that there is more than sufficient evidence to find that Tristan Larson had a depraved and reckless state of mind at the time that he struck Easton Felix too hard on the front of his head. Now, Mr. Larson has also argued that his confession, which many of these facts come from, that's how we know he hit him hard, because Mr. Larson says that himself. That's how we know that he hit him too hard, because Mr. Larson says that himself. That's why it's important for Mr. Larson to try and suppress his confession. However, as Justice Myron pointed out, at the time that he waived his rights, there was not emotion involved. He's asked the question, do you understand these rights, after they've been read to him from the Miranda card that we've all accepted for many, many years as being sufficient, legally sufficient to impart knowledge of rights? And he says, do you understand those rights? An unequivocal yes, he understood those rights. Then the further question do you want to talk to me? And he says, yeah. And what's interesting is when you look at that transcript on page 2, so on page 1 of Exhibit 16A, he says, yes, I understand my rights. I'm willing to waive them. I'm willing to talk to you. And then on the next page, he starts talking about, I'm sorry that I lied about this. I'm sorry that I didn't tell the truth the first time. He's there at that point in time. He wants to unburden himself. He wants to tell the truth. He wants to get it out in the open, what really happened. And I think that's a very powerful indicator of voluntariness in this case, that he apologizes for lying. Now he wants to tell the story.
A number of the other remarks that he makes during his interview with the detective seem to indicate that he understands the nature of this interview. He understands that he's being investigated for a crime. Is that factored into the decision that was made before, or do we need something additional, like Mr. Schreiber suggesting?
You don't need anything additional. You've got a very clear understanding of the rights and a very clear waiver, and you've also got him telling Detective Pell that he's motivated to.
Mr. Schreiber argues to us that there's no evidence that he understood the consequences of the rights that he was waiving.
Well, that's right in the Miranda warning. It informs the defendant, it informs the suspect that anything they say can and will be used against him in a court of law. So he's told the consequences, and then he says yes. And we're kind of hearing for the first time here today, because this wasn't argued in the briefing, it wasn't argued below that I'm aware of, where everything that we understand about Miranda and waiver is suddenly now insufficient, and that we need to re-examine all of that and look at whether he truly understood what he was doing here or not. I would submit to the court that any larger argument about whether Miranda needs to be revisited has been waived, because that has not been briefed to this court. The only issue that's been briefed to this court is whether under existing law there was a knowing and intelligent waiver. And it's very clear on page 1 of Exhibit 16A that there was. And you can see the video also for yourself, as you point out, that at that time, these emotions hadn't welled up yet. And even once they did, as the trial court found, as Judge Rank found, Detective Pell was patient. He waited for Mr. Larson to compose himself again before he continued on with questioning. And those findings of fact by the court, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 19, they're not even contested. In the appellant's opening brief, they agree that that's what happened. But they simply say, they disagree with the conclusion that the court drew that allowing him to compose himself still was not an adequate waiver. So we just, even though, yes, we don't want people making waivers when they're distraught. We want them to do it knowingly and intelligently. That's not the case here. He was allowed to compose himself and before there was any further questioning after he had these emotional episodes.
Did the court determine that the statement was voluntarily given or just that the Miranda warnings were voluntarily given?
Both. So there was a competent waiver and he understood what he was doing. So case law has been pretty clear that, first of all, this was a valid waiver. And second of all, that hitting a child with that level of force, you're a grown man, you have arm strength, fist strength, hitting a child at that age, under age of 3, is inherently dangerous and reckless and depraved. And the Huggins case, the Trogdon case from North Carolina, both came to that conclusion, as has South Dakota law. So we would ask that this court affirm the convictions of second degree murder and aggravated battery of an infant. The jury had a choice between second degree murder and first degree manslaughter. And based on these facts, they convicted Mr. Larson of second degree murder. And we would ask you to affirm those convictions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Shriver, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
I think the one thing I want to focus on more than anything else is Mr. Sweetland says my client swooped down and hit this young boy. I don't think there's evidence in the record that suggests that. You know, there were various terms of art that were used by the detective, used by my client when he was interrogated. Push is what happened here. This was a push. Those were the last words used by Brent Kempema and Detective Pelley. Now, it wasn't a blow to the forehead that killed this young boy. My client pushed him. The unintended consequence was that he hit the floor and he ended up passing away. That's an unfortunate consequence. That is not a foreseeable consequence in this
case. There were a number of medical experts that testified that the cause of death was an acceleration-deacceleration injury, correct?
I believe so.
Did any of them, to your recollection, testify that it was the blow by your client that actually caused the death?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe so. It was coming into contact with the floor that caused the intracranial and interocular bleeding, is my understanding, my recollection from the record. And there were two, Dr. Randall testified and Dr. Snell also testified in this particular case. But it wasn't the push that killed him. And I want to focus for a second on Detective Pelley. I have not had a case where I've had the state's witness that I feel ended up on my side more favorable to me than happened in this case on the cross-examination. And that's not to be a statement against Detective Pelley. This is a guy with 17 years of experience who testified truthfully, who was the person who interrogated Tristan for at least an hour. He agreed my client told him the truth. He believed what he told him. He said, I believed him when he said this was an accident. And the word accident was thrown out throughout that entire interrogation by my client. And that's what Officer Pelley testified to in the trial
Well, you wouldn't have had the benefit of it, I guess, if your motion to suppress would have been granted.
That's true. That is absolutely true. But we may not be here today had that happened.
And that was the focus of your argument, though, or part of the focus of your argument that you presented to the jury that the jury rejected.
The accident?
No, that part of your argument was that Detective Pelley doesn't even think this is a homicide, that he thinks it's an accident. You presented that to the jury, and obviously the jury did not accept that theory of the case.
You're right.
So what is the premise that we should reject the jury's consideration here and say that they were wrong?
That there isn't evidence to show that he had a depraved mind or that my client acted recklessly.
The cases in our jurisprudence where a single push or a blow, I'm speaking of Haroof or Falkenberg, State v. Falkenberg, State v. Haroof, where a single blow or a push has resulted in death in circumstances like this.
And I've got Falkenberg in my notes, and I'm just going to refer to it. In Falkenberg, as I recall, when the boy hit the floor, I believe the actor knew that he had died when he hit the floor. And that wasn't the situation here. Because when my client realized that he was unresponsive, his reaction was to do something to save this boy. He called mom right away, told mom what was going on, picked the boy up, put him on the couch. Elizabeth came home. They called mom, come help us out. So Tristan's reaction to what happened after it was nothing but trying to save this boy's life.
Well, but the jury could have certainly looked at this 40-minute break and said he didn't bother to call medical assistance. Standing and watching him is not really helping. And jury certainly could have considered that in its assessment of his responsibility as well. You agree?
They could have. They absolutely could have. You know, one thing trial lawyers would love to be able to do is be a mouse in the corner when a jury deliberates. We don't have the benefit of doing that. He was convicted. He was found guilty. I don't argue with that. And I'm not, as I indicated before, I'm not asking the court to reassess the evidence here. I'm asking, telling the court or advising the court, there is no evidence here of a depraved mind. There's no evidence here of somebody who acted with depravity, because what happened before, his conduct before taking care of this child, Elizabeth Felix, I believe she even testified, he acted like a father and he cared for this boy. And his conduct afterwards showed the same exact thing. He went to Sioux Falls. This matter occurred over 2 days while this young boy was being seen by doctors. He cared about this young boy. And as Mr. Sweetland said, it was not a first-degree murder case. It was a second-degree murder case is what it was. But at the end, the jury did find him guilty of second-degree murder and aggravated battery of an infant. But I wanted to focus on Detective Pelley because what I perceived to be the most important piece of evidence in this case for the state, in my opinion, turned out to be the most important piece of evidence for us, and that was Detective Pelley's testimony in this case.
Of course, the detective's testimony as to whether or not he believed the matter was accidental, ultimately it is a determination for the jury.
I agree.
Correct?
I agree.
And then I think it was referenced previously, but when you refer to the term accidental here, if we're talking about that meaning he didn't intend to kill him or even intend to harm him, this is the crime for which he was convicted does not require that specific intent, correct?
I agree. I agree 100%.
And were there any jury instructions given with regard to this being an excusable or justifiable homicide?
No, there were not. But I would refer you, Justice Devaney, there was an instruction on recklessness or reckless in this case. And I'm just paraphrasing what it says. It was jury instruction number 36. Conscious and unjustifiable disregard of a substantial risk that Larson's conduct, the jury instruction didn't say Larson's, would cause a certain result or be of a certain nature. That's an unintended unforeseeable consequence is what happened here. And I don't think there's any evidence in this record at the trial that suggested other than that. I don't think the state tried to make an argument that he knew what was going to happen.
And that's precisely the argument that you made to the jury, correct?
That
it was an unforeseeable consequence of his actions.
That's exactly right. And I believe even Dr. Randall, when he testified, his statement was the push was intentional, but he could not tell with any degree of certainty whether or not what happened was intentional or an accident. With that, unless there are any other questions, I don't have anything more. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiber. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.